Why We Bleep is sponsored by Signal Sounds. I live in such a beautiful and like-minded community of musicians and free thinkers. And that's why I've taken to taking my speakers and pointing them out of the windows so that I can let everyone in my neighborhood enjoy my difficult drone project. I need a little artillery for the old sonic warship, if you know what I mean. So I went to signalsounds.com and unleashed a few pennies. I bought the Future Retro Vectra. It's a four-joystick wavetable synth. That's right, four joysticks in one synthesizer, followed by a French amuse-bouche in the form of the microfreak Stella. My goodness, shame they can't see it, but they can definitely hear it. While I was there, I thought I'd skill up a little, so I got Omri Cohen's Modular Cookbook, an actual book that's full of modular synth patch ideas that you can apply to all kinds of things. Too late for that, though. I'm just going to stick on an arpeggiator and hope for the best. Finally, I thought all of this noise needed a bit of a structure. So I've got the Neutral Labs Elmira 2. It's a hybrid digital analog wavetable and non-wavetable drone madness machine. I have to level with you. I'm being evicted next week. But on the plus side, no rent payments means more money for synthesizers. So if you'd like to end up sleeping in the back of your car but covered in synths like Smaug the Dragon, visit signalsounds.com. That's signalsounds.com. P.S. You will need an address. Why We Bleep is sponsored also by thonk.co.uk. Steve from Thonk asked me to tell you about a very unusual and interesting product that they are selling. That would be a thing called Clacktronics Build Your Own Modular. It's a ring binder with pages in it, but the pages are made of PCB material and contain all the instructions you need to snap out all the PCBs from the pages and then solder your own modular synthesizer from the parts from the ring binder. Panels included, I might add. You obviously need to solder in the components, and obviously you can buy your own components, but Thonk do sell a kit that gives you all the parts included. And the idea is by following along the instructions, snapping out the little bits, you build a 12-module Eurorack system with a power supply, two VCOs, a mixer, attenuverters, VCF, dual VCA, LFO, envelope, two passive multiples, and two enclosures. So that is the Clacktronics Build Your Own Modular. Check it out at thonk.co.uk/shop/BYOM. Visit thonk.co.uk. There is an absolutely insane amount of different ways to make electronic music. And as we think about different ways to make electronic music, I think if you're like me, you're always thinking, is this method the one that's going to make the most sense and kind of unlock amazing music for me? Am I going to be able to effortlessly produce interesting things with this method versus all of the other ones that I've tried? And of course, every method of making electronic music requires effort because it requires that you learn some probably slightly weird system. And it could be a DAW like Ableton Live, or it could be a sequencer like a BeatStep Pro and a load of things on a table. But today I want to talk about a completely alternative way of making music, and actually one that is, I don't even know how to put this, but it's obtuse, but it's incredibly accessible. And it also has unbelievably on-point parallels to all of the things that I've tried to do with Eurorack modular synthesizers. And I'm talking about live coding and the concept of the Algo Rave. What is an Algo Rave? Well, if you don't know that, you are in luck, because today you're going to find out. An Algo Rave is a rave where musicians write little snippets of code live on stage on their laptops, and everyone dances to the results. the live bits of code that they write, they are improvising in the moment, just like you would do with a modular synthesizer or a double bass, piano, saxophone, and the vocalist in a jazz quartet. It is amazing. People write little efficient snippets of code, hit control and enter, and amazing, strange, hypnotic, repetitive, unrepetitive, curious, amazing music comes out of it. And I do urge you to check out some of the music from the Algo Rave scene, because a lot of it is amazing. If you're like me, you don't understand coding at all beyond 10 print, I am cool, 20 go to 10 run. And so I'm simultaneously fascinated and also intimidated by this skill. But what I want this conversation with Alex McLean, who is the person who created the term Algo Rave, and is also the brain behind a thing called Tidal Cycles, which is to say, Tidal Cycles is a free live coding interface sort of system and writing very simplistic pieces of code. And I do mean simplistic. And then by appending extra little words with a number or a value, you can make it alternate, concatenate, put your thing down, flip it and reverse it. So if you get a chance to see some Algo Raving, what you see is really, really small amounts of writing that result in really interesting, fascinating dance music coming out of the speakers. And what is so amazing about this, what is so, so, so good, is it is free. I'm eternally fascinated by efficient ways to create interesting music that I wouldn't have done with another tool. And I just think this is such a fantastic, such accessible thing. And so this conversation was really me wanting to ask Alex the kind of beginner questions about live coding, how it came to be, and also kind of what do we need to know? What, you know, should we try this? How do we go about trying this? Because I just think we should. With only a few words and a few variables, you can spit out amazing music. So if you're enjoying Why We Bleep, please do consider sponsoring on Patreon. That is patreon.com/mylarmelodies in order to support future bleeps and bleepins. But with this, I will leave you be. We will speak to Alex and then we'll talk more afterwards. Get ready to have an Algo Rave. Thanks. For you, what defines a good live music experience? What was your best one?
Because I've spent so much time in the live coding community, I don't really see that many bands. When I do, I'm always so impressed. Seeing someone like Stereolab and just feeling the movement between them, the kind of shared pulse, but how that shifts and how they're responding to each other has a really human feel to it. So I think in terms of remembering being impressed, I think it's just having that human feel that I kind of miss in live coding to some extent.
Because you do get collaborations, don't you?
Yeah. So that's something really nice to do with live coding, is sort of collaborate with percussionists or vocalists and kind of get that feel. I think still live coders tend to set the pulse rather than responding to other people. I want to experiment more with kind of machine listening or having sensors on percussionists, that sort of thing, so that live coders can start to not drive the pulse so much. But I think in terms of live performance, that's what it's about, isn't it? It's about seeing someone move to make music, to sort of as a way in to sort of buy into the kind of giving yourself to it as an audience member. And I guess that's what live coders are trying to do by projecting their screens a bit. So you see the movement on the screen of the cursor. That's what we tend to do when we're live coding. usually it's projected behind. Kind of look a bit like a PowerPoint presentation sometimes. But so you're kind of met with this vision of someone, or maybe a collaboration of several people, staring quite intently at their screens, but then you see what they see, movement of the cursor. And I think there's actually something really nice about that, seeing the rhythm of the text being typed, but, and then seeing things get deleted again.
Yeah.
Like having, seeing people change their minds, which I guess you might see if it's like an instrumental performance, but you really see it in live coding. So you'll kind of get, yeah, a bit of access into the thought process. Even if you don't understand the code, you can see these decision points. Usually the screen flashes when the code is enacted, sort of evaluated, put into action. So you see those points as well.
But what is the significance of that, I suppose? It's like, why do you need to show it on stage? For you, what's the driving force behind it?
I think it's still an open question. Like when I was first live coding, I kind of thought the code was a bit distracting. To the audience, yeah. Oh. Like, I think there's something about reading which stops you from listening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some contention in your brain, like being able to, it's like different channels of language and you can only really attend to one at the same time. So I don't really like the idea of someone reading code in order to understand the music more, or at least I didn't. But then there was a profoundly deaf audience member called Annie, who later became a live coding musician, and started performing Algaraves. Shout out to Annie. And he complained to me because at some point in the performance I switched on this strobe light and then he found it really difficult to read the code and he felt he could access it less.
That's really interesting. Like the equivalent of being able to read music and hearing it in your head.
Yeah, which I kind of react against because I'm an improvising musician. I don't really like the idea of notation, even though live coding is all about notation. So there's a bit of a kind of conflict there.
But you don't come with anything pre-prepared. That's the point. Is you haven't got like, you're not control C, control V-ing from a spreadsheet or a notebook, you know.
No, not usually. Sometimes I have, like if I've had to do like, 2-hour performance, I might prepare some things. Another live coders do often pre-prepare things like that, come with really kind of produced tracks, which they then work with live. So there's different sort of approaches. But yeah, I really do like the kind of more improvisatory approach of not knowing what's going to happen next and being surprised at what the code's doing and then responding to that, looking for patterns and then adding strange transformations to it and then seeing what happens. Kind of really grounding the process of writing code in perceiving the output and sort of having a coding process that's really sort of led by perception.
Do you mean by you reacting to what you've done?
Yeah. Because it's this weird feedback loop where you're writing code, which you understand on the code level. But once you actually run it, it's running in a way that can be very complex and beyond your imagination.
Yes.
Except you can understand it completely just by listening to it.
Yeah. Because, of course, you have an emotional response or not.
Yeah.
Then assume that is what you're doing. Effectively, you might have an intuitive idea to try something because it's worked in the past, but then ultimately you're hitting enter and then seeing if you feel anything here and keep repeating until you do, right? I mean,
And I think that's generally how all creative people work, really. If they're working with any material, they're not just coming up with this kind of perfect idea that they're projecting into the world. They're working with material and seeing and responding to it as they're shaping it.
Yeah, any artist is going to like squint at their canvas and be like, am I there yet or not? Yeah. Or where do I need to go next? You know?
Yeah.
You probe your, and I know that from my own, like when I make music or when I mess with any piece of equipment, I'm ultimately kind of improvising, but I'm trying to see if I respond on some emotional level to it, which is but that is the nature of live on stage improvisation too.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd talk about emotion really. I think for me, it's just having that physical feeling which I suppose you could think about in terms of emotion.
Do you mean maybe it makes you want to dance or that?
Yeah, yeah, it has that physical feeling. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like sensing that pattern in it, and finding unexpected interactions between different layers or,
I want to ask you more about processes, like literally like what you can do with like tidal cycles in a bit, but
yeah,
it'd be interesting to get your sort of why you feel you are, why did you go down this route? Why do you work in this field? And did you come from the world of like more trad electronic music gear and trad being stuff that's literally only 40 years old? But
yeah, I think most live coders probably come at it as musicians. I mean, live coding is not just about music, I should say. Like you get visual artists, choreographers, also live coding. Any kind of time-based art form you can do live coding with.
Okay.
But I'm really just a musician. But yeah, yeah, how do I get? So I'm definitely from the other side. I'm sort of a programmer who's come to music.
Yeah.
So yeah, in university, I met my friend Adrian Ward, who was really into Autechre at the time. And we were both like interested in coding. He was on a Media Lab Arts course. And eventually we formed a band where we just decided we wanted to, just make music writing our own code.
Okay. That was your first music that you made? You hadn't been doing...
I'd mess around with like... I'm not sure if it was Fruity Loops then. This was around the year sort of 2000. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit of trackers and a little bit of sequencing, but not too much. And no instrumental stuff really. So yeah, really came to it from the point of view of saying, I'm a Perl programmer, like this programming language Perl,
yeah.
So I'll use that to use it then.
Okay.
Yeah, Aid was using various other languages and we just started forming, yeah, we formed a band called Sleb and started performing music in London. And yeah.
And how did you perform? If it was written in Perl, was it, what was your stage show?
Well, around then you were starting to see projectors in little venues. So we started projecting our screen just to show what we were doing. And yeah, running bits of scripts and things we'd written. Not really live coding at the start. Aid started live coding. It wasn't called live coding then. No one else was really doing it apart from people we hadn't met yet. But yeah, I guess, it felt like, yeah, so we were projecting, just showing our interfaces, our user interfaces. I guess back then there was no idea of creative coding or the idea that a programmer could be creative at all was sort of not really a thing.
Yeah, yeah, especially in this field of music, right? I mean, I know that there was obviously there's like a grand tradition of grand tradition. Again, I sort of shouldn't use those words when this stuff is like 100 years old or whatever. But
yeah.
Obviously, like early computer music is a thing, you know, like punch cards and, you know, what's it called? I can't think of it now. People can put in comments and so forth. But like the old, you know, those old mega room sized, you know, those old school things that would just be banging out sine waves.
But even
you know,
then,
there is a tradition
like
of this.
In Earcam in France, for example, there's still no idea there of the idea of a programmer being creative. It's like you'd get these traditional composers and then the programmer would be brought in to sort of
to make a tool that they that the musicians could use.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So. And so what were you triggering like MIDI gear or where was the sound coming from? Was it all samples? Or?
Yeah, Aid made a sampler.
Like a software sampler.
Yeah, software sampler. And so, yeah, and started coding his own effects and things. And so, yeah, everything was completely homemade from the operating, not the operating
not
system.
But yeah.
That was the idea. We just wanted to make everything ourselves.
What did it sound like?
Kind of broken sort of gabber.
Sounds great. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you can still go to slub.org, S-L-U-B.
Slub.
And, yeah, listen to various things that we did.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, and probably haven't changed that much since.
you were live coding. Well, you weren't live coding, you were coding your own tools, and then what's the journey that takes you from that to having something like Tidal Cycles, which I know is obviously a very it's a long journey, I'm sure, and it's 20 years.
Well, part of it's kind of building up a community of people interested in live coding, so meeting up with other people, sort of starting to do festivals and things. So part of it's like a cultural development.
What point did it, did you get like invites to play at festivals with the idea that you were going to do play code on stage? You know, how did it sort of, is there a turning point or some sort of tipping point?
We went into it pretty much straight away because Aid was quite a well-known software artist. So he was being invited to festivals to show his generative art software. Right. We just got gigs on the back of that and it just kind of took over really. Remember playing, like the first time people danced to our music was in the Paradiso in Amsterdam. So, you know, nice venue, just jumped straight into it. Yeah. Can't really believe it really. It was an amazing experience.
And I think, but it's interesting, like the laptop musician thing is a kind of phenomenon. Yeah, that's kind of when it started to happen, wasn't it? It was like the kind of 2000s. And then there's been this quite sort of, I think what's interesting about what you're doing is there's a quite an anti-laptop thing now, you know, which is this idea that there's something naughty or cheating or unsatisfying about having a laptop on stage. But of course, it's all a question of what you're doing, you know, on that laptop, which I see is why you would show it on stage, to show what you can see is not email. It's not like, you can see that we're working really hard.
I think there's interesting waves of people laptops coming in, going out again a few times.
Our fashion.
Our fashion.
But they're due to come back, I think.
I've just always used laptops. Well, actually, at the start, I used to take my big beige PC.
Yeah, wicked. So, and then, but at what point did you start live coding? Where does that... Because that is distinct, presumably. You were, back in these early days, you'd have written everything beforehand and you were just kind of writing
starting
it?
Yeah, stopping, sort of handmade interfaces. But live coding's around sort of year 2005. There was this event in Hamburg that my friends Renata Weisser and Julian Rochruber organised. Well, friends now, first time I met them. And then we formed TopLap, the organization for the promotion of live algorithm programming. That event. And so that was where it just like seemed there was something in the air that were like people, you know, about four or five people dotted around the world, like Go Wang in the States, Nick Collins in Cambridge at the time, just in starting to explore the possibilities of writing code live to make music, which was quite a radical idea at the time. And it took a while for me before it became more than an idea and something where I was really able to do it. And that's how Tidal came around, really, was sort of trying to get from the point of what the reality was, which was like working with this general purpose programming language, Perl, to try and make music. And it would take me minutes to even make a sound sometimes, which is quite boring for me.
Wait, so you would literally be like, start from absolute scratch with a language that is not designed for music?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was the design pressure to make something like Tidal, particularly working with my friend Alex Garagocci, a Basque drummer. So he was sort of free improvising jazz drummer, really pushing me to do from scratch live coding. But
and this person, would they drum with you, or they were just, they through their nature, they were literally pushing you to do it?
Oh, yeah, it was a collaboration. Yeah,
so they were
so they were drumming away while I was sort of writing some code.
Yeah, there's something I saw, there's one of the videos where someone had a TR-8, you know, the Roland TR-8, and I assume was kind of doing live you know, XOX drums over code as well.
That's my friend Sam is class compliant audio interfaces, CCAI. That's our band name. We like to do that. That's great because you have that really hands-on shaping of tension and everything with the 808. And then, live coding doing weird twisted beats on top.
I find that, that you get basically... you kind of get a bit of the best of both worlds, I assume. It's like, and some... you know, from the rare times that I've collaborated with other people when I'm improvising on stage, there's definitely like security in having another person that's going to like give you like the option to think a little more about what you do.
Yeah.
And not have dead air, you know.
Yeah. And but, for me, it's just wonderful experience because live coding and instrumental performance, whether it's with a set of real drums or a drum machine, it's just you're in... it's such a different approach to time, really, because when you're hitting drums, you hit a movement makes a sound. Whereas with live coding, you're lots of movements, sort of moving your cursor around, writing code, and then running it, and then it makes lots of sound. So it's like lots of movements to go into lots. Yeah, it's a very different relationship with time. But then when you're collaborating, that kind of melts away and you're just in the same space. And it's nice.
Yeah.
There's no argument about whether what you're doing is making music then, because, you know, there it is. I think that's sort of, it's almost a political act, really, sort of using code to write music, because rather than making a statement about what code is, you're just doing it. Sort of saying, this is what I think code should be. It should be about this sort of cultural communal experience where we're just exploring patterns together. It's like, and everything can be changed. It's something we have control of, as opposed to the kind of pervasive idea of algorithms, which is these things that control us, that control what we see. It's kind of pushing a different vision of what technology can be about.
It sounds like you're saying it's like a visual analogy for the fact that humans control computers, not the background.
In general, we don't. It's not like saying we live in this ideal world, but it's like giving us a holiday from that, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's like saying this is what technology should be about. It should be about craft. It should be about giving us the ability to grow things, rather than this approach to technology, which is about overgrowth and about technology's control. I'm kind of paraphrasing Ursula Franklin here in her book and lecture series, The Real World of Technology. Talks a lot about this kind of difference in between different approaches to technology and how things have become so much about control. Yeah.
Speaking of control, so it's, there is a point obviously where you realize that you can do enough that you can basically program live on stage.
Yeah.
You can do that from complete scratch, but obviously then there's a point where you realize that you need a kind of specialized language. You need like a there can't be like a 2-minute dead air.
Yeah.
You know. So where do you get, how did Tidal come about, and what does it afford?
So it came about because I was lucky to have a scholarship to do a research degree in Goldsmiths in London in the computing department, which was sort of filled with composers and musicians at the time, and music psychologists, really interesting. It came out of my thesis work, really.
Right.
So I had like 3 to 4 years where I could just explore ideas around what live coding meant to me, and Tidal was the result. And it really came back to this kind of idea of patterns. So this idea that, algorithms and patterns, they're kind of synonymous. They're kind of, so if you think about an algorithm as a pattern, it does foreground perception to start with, because a pattern doesn't really exist until you perceive it. But it also foregrounds the kind of way in which it's described and made. So if we think about something like weaving, you have the warp and the weft, and they interfere with each other according to a certain pattern. And according to the different colours of the warp and weft, you get this surface image, which actually isn't in the structure. It's not in the colours of the threads. It's in how they interfere with each other. So it's that kind of idea of an interference pattern where you take different elements, combine them in different ways and different scales, and then by doing that something new comes out. So I've become really interested in, and this is something which is, I think, common to all music anyway, but when you make that algorithm really explicit, I think it becomes something particular about writing down how you make something in a really quite formal way, really, as an extra step in that creative process of action, notation, and then computation, and then perception in this kind of feedback loop. That whole process, I think, is the pattern. And that's really what Tidor is geared up to afford, is not saying how you do something or what you want, but just writing a piece of code that's really like a what if question, like what if you take these two things, transform them or combine them in this way, what happens? And then the computer will do it for you, make sound, and then you listen to the pattern, work out what is actually interesting about that from a musical perspective, and then that informs your next change to the code. And that decision making process becomes musical in itself. The transition from what it was before to what it becomes next becomes part of the music, and when you make that change becomes really important as well, which is quite unique to live coding as opposed to coding some app, is that the actual timing of writing the code, making those decisions, is really, of course, very it's critical as well. Yeah.
That's one of my questions was going to be, do you have a way of sort of, and I'm sure you obviously massively do, but it's that idea of having ways to cue things up and to make things happen at the right time. And I heard like some of your performances, like I'm hearing you fade things in.
Right.
I think. Or maybe I perceive that just as a sound was like brought in and brightened or made more kind of more obvious. But it felt like you were able to kind of mix almost, but obviously wave. I don't
that
know.
That might be the work with Sam Shaw, who also performs as Damu in CCI, I mentioned, because he's not only doing the drum machine, he's also mixing what I'm doing. Yeah. So he's got like a DJ filter on each pattern, as well as gain and reverb and stuff. Mm. So he's like adding shape to what I'm doing as well.
I know. I definitely watched like one of the performance where it's just you doing the music, and it felt like you were like mixing, as it were. But okay, I think comes from perhaps like a developed and seasoned experience of how to use that program. And you, because that's, I suppose, is my question, is like what goes through your head. Although that I'd like to ask more about also the types of commands that are in Tidal. Cycles? Mm. Is it Tidal Cycles is the name of the current iteration?
Yeah, it used to be called Tidal, but then I think Jay-Z released a music store.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? Did that mess things up? And
just to differentiate it in game research, has made it Tidal Cycles. So
okay. Well, the piece of software is Tidal Cycles. I suppose what did you learn from the process of codifying? It's an interesting thought. You had to presumably try codify processes into commands, musical concepts, and it's like, how do you, I don't know how you did that. And I suppose then the question is, what are some of the ones that, you know, maybe when we get a demonstration, but I'd be interested to understand what the types of transfers you were doing are, so that, because I obviously do stuff with modular synths, we have Euclidean pattern generators in modular synths, you know, and so I kind of understand that, and I understand that you would have taken that, but I'm curious what else you codified, what else did you find words for?
Yeah, is it Laurie Spiegel, the early electronic musician? She's got a really nice paper she wrote in the 80s about patterns, the different kinds of pattern transformations. Her argument was that in sequences you should have copy and paste, and then on the same level you'd have this whole other set of pattern transformations you can do. I think she's got 12 different categories in there, so that's worth a read for just thinking about the different kinds of pattern transformations you can have. But yeah, there's loads actually, and it's just like coming up with an idea about what you can do with a pattern, and then yeah. So for example, if you have a sequence 1, 2, 3, 4, you could like shift it by a quarter to get 4, 1, 2, 3, and then progressively do that. Yeah. So then you get 2, 3, 4, 1, 2.
Yeah.
And then eventually it would get back to where it started. So that would be, that's called iter in Tidal. But then the strange thing is that if you're iterating by a quarter, you can also pattern the amount that you're iterating by.
Right.
And that's true of all Tidal commands. So it's one thing to have a pattern transformation, which is just like shifting each repetition, but then being able to pattern that amount that you're... So it's a bit like modular synthesis. You can take any number and plug something else in, like another pattern. So yeah, shifting time, sort of increasing and decreasing density, things like... Jux is really big in Tidal. So Jux.
J-U-X?
Yeah, so it stands for juxtapose.
Okay.
So if you had rev, which is reverse, which is just playing a pattern backwards, and then if you had jux rev, it would juxtapose the reversal, which means it would only happen in one speaker. So if you had a stereo system, one speaker would be playing the pattern normally, the other speaker would be playing it backwards.
I've heard you do this,
yeah,
and it's one of your favourite tricks, and it's a really lovely one because it makes everything very headphony and like...
Yeah, it's great on the headphones, but it's surprisingly good on a massive sound system. Like, this is something which sound engineers don't always like to do, but I really like being panned hard left and hard right. In a big venue, sound engineers don't necessarily like it because you don't really get a stereo image, but that's not the same as... not playing something at all in one massive stack of speakers. And
because, if it goes on the other side, it'll bounce around the room doing interesting things. And...
Yeah, it just plays the room. It's great. Yeah, I really like, hard stereo effects. It's great. And when you're patterning those effects live, it's sort of,
There's an Orteca track, which is a complete... The track is mono...
Yeah,
but the whole track is reversed in the right channel. So the entire in the mid, there is a midpoint where the track is completely in the middle, right in the middle of the thing. But everything you're hearing is like the whole track, like reversed, and it is a wicked piece of music as well. It's actually really nice.
Yeah, I'm going through a stage at the moment where I kind of came to a point with Tidal where it felt like. Development was slowing down, felt pretty complete. I mean, there's so many pattern transformations in there that don't really need anymore, especially because you can just make a new one just by combining two other transformations. That's the nice thing about language is that it's so composable. You can just take any two things and put them together and make a new thing. So if you do add a new function, it like freshens up all the other ones because you can match it with all the other things. But yeah, recently I've got really into Carnatic music, this practice called conical, which is a sort of vocal, it sounds like speaking the drums, but it's kind of become its own practice over many decades or thousands of years. I'm not sure how long it's gone on for, but it's really mathematical and very... based on these rhythmic, very long, sometimes sort of rhythmic cycles where you're doing these pattern transformations, like adding beats each repetition or taking them away, while also clapping the underlying tala, the underlying sort of metrical cycle. Learning this made me realise how limited Tidal was in terms of kind of additive pattern making. So Tidal's really about taking a cycle and dividing it, whereas conical is much more about working on the kind of level of steps or beats. So at the moment I'm kind of adding all these like a whole new, feels like a whole new half to Tidal, like doubling the number of functions, really, because just coming at pattern making from this different perspective.
Do you mean that as in that you're literally expanding the length of patterns, or what effect does it have? What is the limitation currently? What can't you do?
Well, if you had like the rhythm ABC and the other one DE, with Tidal, if you stuck them together, you'd get ABCDE.
Yeah.
So the DE would be end up slower than the ABC, because yeah, you're splitting the cycle in half. Whereas now I'm adding the functionality, so you can end up with ABCDE, which sounds really basic, because it is. That's the thing about pattern making, is that the fundamentals are super simple. But when you have the ability to compose things together, it ends up incredibly complex. still from these simple, that's why the code's so short, is that it's really simple, but the way you're combining things means you get all these complexities that just come out of it. So for example, if you had wanted to make a 16-beat sequence and you had like a 5-beat phrase that you repeated, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you'd end up with 15 because you'd have 3 repetitions, which make 15, and then you'd have this extra thing on the end. So it would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that would be like a 16-beat sequence. And then one thing you could do is move where the 6 is.
Right.
So you can move that backwards and end up with the second repetition would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then keep moving it back until you get back where you started again, which again sounds really simple. But when you're doing that with an underlying beat as well, and instead of saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, have another 5-beat sequence like dim, dim, taka. So taka is like 2 sounds in one. And then have the underlying beat. So you're going, what would it be? Dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, ta. And that would be the 16-beat sequence.
Yeah.
So you go dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, ta, 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 dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, dim, dim, taka, ta. So just that simple idea of having like 3 repetitions followed by one that you then move, and then changing the source material, which has its own pattern, you end up getting this complex result. And which you could describe in a very short piece of code.
Yeah.
And then play with it.
Well, it sounds like you didn't come up with all of the various permutations. You know, it sounds like there's a lot more scope to improve, like, and to broaden. How many commands are there?
There's 100 or so, but when I perform, you only use a very small subset. My friend Lucy, who I collaborate with a lot, has a band called Epiplocky. She's another live from scratch live coder, so really likes improvising. And she just writes in her notebook like a few functions that she wants to focus on for a performance, and maybe some sounds, and that's her preparation. Because if you have like 4 functions, there's still so many permutations, so many different ways of combining them, but that's all you need.
Because you also, you presumably don't want to be like completely trashing all your code and writing it all from scratch. You almost want to build a little like system and then tinker with it and does that make sense? Is that how it works normally? Because do you quite often like clear screen, as it were, and then just start from scratch?
Through a performance, it just grows in complexity until I can't really work with it anymore, and that's time for a breakdown.
It's tricky in dance music. Obviously, there's an obligation to keep the beat and the sort of keep the kind of flow going. You know, and it's but it's a brave move not to do that.
Yeah, I think you can still keep something there, but strip it right down.
Can you have loads and loads of concurrent sounds, or is there a sort of? I was going to ask you, what is the minimum spec computer that people would need to run tidal cycles?
Anything really. And there's this new version called Strudel, which just runs in a web browser as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and that will just run on a phone or something. It's really low barrier to entry and everything.
So Strudel, just to be clear, is just a completely web-based.
Yeah.
It has sounds built in. Do you need to have sounds on your computer?
It has some sounds built in. You can add your own sounds as well. It has synthesizers and stuff. So this is a port of Tidal to JavaScript in particular, but just runs in a web browser. It's a project I started a couple of years ago, but immediately this guy, Felix Roos, jumped in, and he's actually done more development on it than me at this point. And more recently, Jade Rowland has come along, and she's added some really nice synthesizers and stuff. So it's a nice open source.
Do you mean
sort of
when you say synthesizers, it's actually sound generating stuff,
yeah,
or is it all samples?
It's a mixture, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Up to this point, I think I assumed it was all just samples,
Personally, I do use a lot of samples, mostly samples, but for example, Tidal uses another live coding environment called SuperCollider for the sound backend, and so you can have synthesizers coded up in that. It's an amazing DSP environment. As well as triggering samples. And even when you're triggering samples, it's really lots of granular synthesis going on, and also lots of effects to manipulate them. So,
because samples are obviously inherently limiting to some degree,
yeah,
which is not necessarily a bad thing, especially if you're coding live on stage. But it is interesting, the idea of almost creating modulators, things that would change the sound and not just the melody. What sort of things does it afford?
I really like taking a long sample, chopping it up into bits, and then patterning those bits.
Yeah.
So it's a very patterned approach to granular synthesis. But then, yeah, there's all kind of distortion. It's really fun to apply vowel formant filter on things so that things sound like vowels.
So you can just use a command and it will just put it through a vowel filter.
Yeah, so because everything's a pattern. Yeah. There's patterns all the way down, so there's a pattern for the notes, but then you can have on the same level of complexity, a pattern on reverb, for example, or distortion, or any effect you can think of, you could pattern.
When you say pattern, do you mean a series of complex modulation, or what does it mean?
So in terms of Tidal, a pattern is any function of time. But what it actually in practice means, what you usually do is start off with a sequence, which is its own little mini language, it's called the mini notation. And you start that as a kind of source material, and then you apply the pattern transformations to that. So it's a pattern in the sense of a sequence, but also a pattern in terms of a series of transformations to change it into something different, or, as I say, combine it with other sequences.
I feel like this might be a good time to have a demonstration.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
So, yeah, this is Strudel. It's quite new, as I was saying, 2 years old. But it's pretty much on the same level in terms of features as Tidal now. So it's really exciting to see a little community form around it. Free open source and just runs in the web. You just go to strudel.cc. What was I saying? I was saying you start off with a sound. I've got some loaded into this already. There's a sound tab where you can see the built-in drum machines. That's quite
heck. And when you say a drum machine, is that like a whole collection of sounds?
Yeah, this is sounds. So, for example, a Boss DR 2020 ride sound.
One of those. Yep.
And then there's like, yeah.
But you don't want to type that whole thing. There's the Roland R8. I just bought one of those.
Yeah. No, you wouldn't want to type all that. So what you do is just say what the drum machine is by saying bank, let's say Roland TR-909. And then you say what sample set, like a kick, bass drum. So there's the kick. So here I'm just building up a sequence.
So you type BD-SD-BD.
Yeah, with a little squiggle in between, which is just like a rest. So if I run that, you see it flash. So the nice thing about Strudel is you can actually see what is actually playing, which can be nice when you're when it gets quite complex.
You just typed HH times 2.
Yeah.
So it plays two hats in that little space.
Yeah.
I mean, this seems very straightforward to understand. You've typed literally BDSD, HHBD.
Yeah.
And you are hearing bass drum, snare drum, hi-hat, bass drum.
Yeah, so this is really direct. And that's a nice thing. I mean, I think it's good to be able to make sound. If you're improvising from scratch, it's good to do it within a second or two and actually make those changes within a couple of seconds as well. So you really get that live feedback. There's a lot more, like you can break down this into sub patterns.
Huh.
So this is actually a step, but broken down into three. So there isn't really a grid in Tidal. There is like the cycle. So you can set how long that lasts. So I can say set CPS, which is the cycles per second. And I could say 0.6. It would speed it up a bit. By default, it's 0.5. So one cycle every 2 seconds. So I can change the overall speed. I could also add a second pattern with maybe something like this. And I can specify notes because this is
sample space. You wrote P2 and then sound folk harp.
Yeah.
And then you've written note C5. You literally write the...
Maybe it needs to be a bit louder.
So you type gain 1.1 to increase the gain.
Yeah.
You also type C5 and then you put in brackets 3.8, which I'm assuming is Euclidean.
Yeah, well spotted, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Euclidean algorithm is really popular for live coding because you just need to give two numbers, the number of sounds and the number of steps, and it just fills them in for you and makes sense.
Effectively,
really.
Try and equally spread 3 steps as best you can across 8 steps.
Yeah, that's exactly.
And it doesn't quite do it, so it gets them slightly closer or further from one step.
Yeah, and that's what sounds so nice, is that it's not quite... you get that little...
The thing what has been bothering me about Euclidean patterns is the fact that they are kind of equally distributed.
Mm.
And I want some kind of weighting where over a period of time it goes away and for a time it comes back. What would you type to like make it so that you didn't just get this monotony? You had some dynamicism? So you had dynamics over time.
Yeah, so if we just focus on that folk harp sound then. So I've got that C5, and then that's the note, and then in brackets 3.8, which is the Euclidean pattern. So if I wanted to pattern, say, the number of steps that are within that 8-step sequence, then I could just use angle brackets around the 3 and add another number, say 5. So this is saying that every other cycle, every other repetition, switch from 3 sounds to 5 sounds.
Interesting. Okay.
So.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
So that's going quite slow at 0.3 cycles per second. I can speed it back up to 0.6.
And what was your trick of like juxing it so that it's different in the right versus the left?
All right. So, yeah, I can add a .jux at the end. And then inside the .jux, I can put a rev. So now it's a classic Jux rev, which you see a lot in Tidal and Strudel performances. So we can hear what that sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
And I can also, as well as reversing it, I could make it go up an octave, maybe, if I can remember how to do that. So if I just add note 12, I think that should hopefully do it. Actually, it's already quite high. I'll actually subtract it instead to make it go down. Or maybe change that to, so it's also patterns. So I could, instead of subtracting 12, I can like sometimes subtract 5, sometimes 2.
Yeah.
And then
you
I could
did a music.
Say, yeah, maybe if I use the off function. So this will allow me to apply something in a similar way, but instead of juxtaposing in space, I can juxtapose in time. Taking a copy of the pattern, shifting it by 0.25, i.e. a quarter.
Yeah.
And then I am going to add maybe 7. That's always sounds quite nice.
Just, no, we need to drown this in reverb.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to like pattern the source tune first. I'll slow it down again and then add more complexity. Let's see. So let's add an E note after that with... But anyway, this is kind of sounding okay.
Yeah, it does.
And yeah, drown it in reverb. I can do that if you want.
Just like a command called drown. You type the word room, 0.7.
Yeah, so that's the amount going into the reverb is room, and then I can say the size of the room it's going into. A set that quite large. Yeah, maybe a bit more.
This is sounding pretty beautiful.
Yeah, and of course I can pattern that, so make it a bit more extreme sometimes.
Oh. that yeah. Sounds so good. Like, I think this is what, like, having heard your performances as well, it sounds good.
Yes.
And that's actually, I mean, because that's something that I often, you know, I often struggle with, especially in the world of modular synths, is it's one thing to be very clever about the way that you construct something and to be like, I've just got a very novel way of doing this, or I've constructed what I consider to be a very clever patch. Mm. But ultimately, does it sound good?
Yeah.
I mean, I return to it endlessly. It's that thing of questioning your guts. It's like,
yeah.
But does it move me? Does it actually sound like music? And it seems like a lot of what I've heard, it really does. Like, it sounds very accessible and very interesting music to listen to. Mm. And yeah, it's composed in a very abstract and a way that to you know, I think many lay people might think is not going to sound good, you know, because how yeah. could it?
Yeah.
Because it's so non-traditional.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, like, being involved with live coding really since its inception or soon after, was that it's nice seeing how it has developed and how it's gone from an idea, which a few people were really obsessed by, into something which is a legitimate way to make music.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it, in terms of becoming a well-practiced live coder, is really about staying in time. Like, it's really difficult not to get completely lost in a particular problem or a particular idea and forget the actual passing of time.
What do you mean by that? As in that the audience isn't on the same journey as you, and you have to be mindful of how they perceive it.
Have to be on the same timeline. And it comes down to counting, really. Like, you have to be aware that the last time you made a change, especially making dance music, how many beats that was.
Yes.
And you have to make a change. And it feels like you then have a deadline coming up. But Okay, the audience is now, according to the this idea of what music is, there should be a change, 16.
Every 16 beats. There's 16 bars. Because you are talking about something that I think consciously about. You know, that's when I'm stood over my modular synth, I am thinking that. And in my head, I like, if I've learned anything, if I have any skill, it's the thing that you develop is the skill to try and listen.
Yeah.
Listen really hard to what you're doing so that you know where you are in that 16 bars.
Yeah.
So you know in your guts, like, oh, I don't have to think about it consciously. I know that it's coming up. It feels you could almost have something in this that literally is showing you, you know, the bars that you almost have like a traffic light or a kind of boredom meter that's like the audience are probably bored now.
Yeah, there is kind of built-in stuff.
Is there?
Like there's some visualization. So.
Oh,
for
look
example,
at that.
You just
basically type the word spiral and a big spiral has appeared, which is kind of showing that visual representation of where you are in the...
Yeah. So if we did it on that beat based thing as well, then you'd actually see the rhythm on the screen as well.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a bit more useful. So now there's like, you can't, it's a bit hard to see actually, but now you actually see the structure of the rhythm in the spiral. And there's also like a piano roll.
I feel like you'd want a specialized keyboard that's got all of the commands written on it.
Yeah. So that's another visualization that's more like, it looks more like a traditional sequencer then, because you have that left to right.
Look how complex it is as well. I mean, it's like, it doesn't take much for you to create patterns.
Yeah, it's all patterns, all the way down.
So should we return to our... What is the best way to learn? That seemed very simple. It's the thing. And obviously, but it's the, you know, it's knowing how to apply these. And I suppose from you teach people how this works. Like, in your experience, what is the best route for someone if they want to give that a go, try what you just did?
Well, Strudel is nice because it has built-in documentation. So you can just jump in and start doing it.
When you say built-in documentation, it's like a thing in the corner that you can and it'll kind of flash the commands on stage or on screen.
So it's just like a built-in tutorial and reference, including sort of live examples, so you can immediately play them,
copy and
change
them. Oh, that's really good.
There's a shuffle button where you get a random pattern that someone else has written and submitted. So it's like community section where you can see like lots of examples, what other people have done.
Is there a kind of, you know, how do you internalize it? What's the best way, do you think? Or is it just get in and play? Or is it, would you advise people to have some kind of goal in mind or what?
Yeah, I'm probably the worst person to ask because I haven't really learned a language apart from through the process of making one. So, from talking to my friends, I think, just get a gig, I suppose, is the best way. And then work towards it.
Work it out on stage.
Because a lot of these live coding events are really open to people just coming along and trying it out. Like, often have slots at the start where people can just have a go.
Like an open mic type thing. Also, just returning to the laptop thing, like you think people basically Strudel, so that you go to strudel.cc is the web address.
Yeah.
And that will run basically, like you do have an audio interface here, but like do you, will it sound, you don't have, I guess there's no like latency, is there? Because obviously you're just hitting the code and it plays, right?
Yeah.
It's not real time in that sense, even though what you are responding in real time to what you hear. But what I mean is, there isn't a thing where you actually play and notice any delay. So it doesn't really matter what computer you have.
That's right, yeah. So latency is not generally a problem with live coding unless you start interfacing with external gear and things.
I did have one question, two questions, which was external gear and also, but syncing to other people.
Yeah.
How does that work?
In Tidal, you can send MIDI clock. But generally, people use the built-in link, Ableton link.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Synchronization.
Yeah. So it responds to Ableton link.
Yeah. In fact, by default, which is quite funny when you're at a live coding event and you're just getting ready and then realise you're on the same network as the person who's performing and you're accidentally changing there.
Yeah.
So you should probably make that default off, really. But super simple. If you have two people running Tidal, then it synchronises. It's not really the equivalent for Strudel yet.
Okay.
You can send MIDI clock, apart from that, there's no, it's just a bit harder to synchronize with something that's running in the web browser, but we'll get there eventually with Link.
What about remote collaboration? Like, you were playing with Hello Cat Food.
Oh, yeah.
But Hello Cat Food, I think, was doing the visuals.
Yeah.
But how did you, sync, or is that just asynchronous? And could you sync? Could two people in different parts of the world, does this afford a sync that isn't possible with other DAWs?
Yeah, so with Hello Cat Food, he was doing the visuals, so sync wasn't so important. I just sent him my stream and then he added to it and sent it on. For synchronized...
Couldn't two people be using like the same instance, like
over
the web or something? Do you know what I mean? Like, is there not some way that two people could literally just be typing into the same screen?
Yeah, you're imagining the real reality of this world, because there's something called Flock. So this is F-L-O-K. No C. So flock.cc. And there you load up and then give the same URL or password to other people, and then they can join and work on the same Strudel code together.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
And again, there's no latency issue because you're just sending the code. And
you're just kind of hearing what it's... You both hear it at the same time.
Yeah, you both hear it at the same time. Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. Like, so flok.cc
That's right.
Is basically collaborative Strudel.
Yeah, it also supports other...
Flock is brands, collaborative Strudel, which is just the sense I never thought
of. It supports other live coding environments, including one for visuals as well. So this fantastic system by Oliver Jack called Hydra. So if you search for Hydra live coding, if you have any photosensitive epilepsy, maybe steer clear.
Be careful.
Or be careful.
It's, because crazy it does.
Immediately can give you heavy strobe experience.
Yeah.
You can have Strudel or several instances of Strudel and Hydra running in the same collaborative web browser thing. So there's people who regularly sort of meet online every week and collaborate, even though they're in different continents.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've been playing a little bit recently. I mentioned it in another podcast, but with Jamtaba, which is really good. Like, I encourage anyone listening to try to Google Jamtaba as an example. Basically, that's a VST plugin that aims to sync DAWs. And it does work. And interestingly, it does it by introducing a huge latency, like a 1 bar or 2 bar latency. So there's buffering time to catch up. And but what it isn't letting you do is kind of both hear the same thing at the same time, which is what is done with this. And because of the sort of fact that you just enter code and execute it. Actually, that's one question. If two people are like playing in the same instance, if they hit return, is it just going to execute your partly formed code, or do you both have your own return basically that you can execute different parts of the screen at different times?
Yeah, it depends. So in Flock using, you probably have separate windows. You can work in the same frame, but you can have multi-frame.
Can you
setup,
like erase so you... other person's like oh, yeah. other people's frames?
Yeah. There's a nice local band called Type, and there's four of them, and they all work in another system actually. Well, the language they use is Fox Dot. I can't remember the name of the multi-user system they use. But yeah, they're really like a Google Doc. They're all in the same window, and you can also each have a different color, so you can see who typed
which
bit of text. You kind of evaluate one block at a time, so it's not like you're running the whole code, and so it can still work when you're written half of one bit of code and someone's working on the other. Because
that's fun. It's just sort of, these are like options that I hadn't really considered were possible. Do you have much experience with other languages and things like, for example, one of the sort of similarly intriguing programming kind of visual type-based well, I say visual, like type-based programming interfaces I saw was Orca, which is where, for those who haven't seen Orca, it looks like a sort of, it uses text, but it looks like a big sort of grid of dots. Yeah. And basically you type single letters and they kind of, and you, by placing letters next to other letters, you build like little music machines where, and I don't know if you, have you tried it? Is that one that you have experience of or thoughts about?
I've looked at it a lot. I've watched other people perform with it. I haven't used it myself. It is really beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a programming language, but with single letter instructions, like you say. And the flow of execution is on screen and in two dimensions.
Yeah.
So it's like it's weird. It's cross super- between a computer game or something.
To me, it felt like the closest actual like modular synth patching, in a sense that locality and like, you know, you almost are, you place something next to each other to patch it in and you build like these little Rube Goldberg music contraptions from letters and how they interact on the screen. So I would definitely encourage people to look at it as an interesting, it's also free. I think that's another thing that we haven't implicitly stated is that Tidal Cycles is completely free of charge.
That's right. Yeah.
Although you are kindly encouraged to please donate to the, if you find it valuable, because obviously I was going to ask you, like, how is that possible? How do you live if you give away the thing?
Yeah.
But when I realize I'm not advocating for like making it cost money if it's possible for it to not, I just, I'm aware of the realities of the fact that you have to.
Yeah. I have had crowdfunding really successfully. Like during lockdown, I did some crowdfunded tutorial videos, which were really great, like enough money to live on. I was working part-time at the time, so it sort of made more through that than my day job. But I gave up that because I've now got a full-time research position. So I'm funded by the UKRI Future Leader Fellowships Programme, which pays for me to work full time on this researching algorithmic patterns. So my work on Tidal and Strudel is included on that, but also research into heritage patterns like weaving, chaotic music I mentioned, juggling, braiding, all these kind of really culturally grounded, often ancient approaches to making through sort of ethno-mathematics, sort of culturally grounded mathematics of pattern.
I said before we started talking that I don't really know the correct questions to ask you about that, but from my perspective, I guess the question is, what can we learn? What do we learn from those things? What do they teach us?
I think it's about how something as often cold and with particular sort of gender norms and kind of I'm talking about computer programming here, something that's grown up through sort of corporate and sort of industrial military purposes often. Often developed in universities but funded by the military. We haven't explored its full potential compared to something like weaving, which is the sort of universal craft that happens all around the world, developed in all different ways, been around for thousands of years, but at the same time is still developing. And the ways that people are continually innovating through it and are also sharing, teaching each other techniques, and have this very, because it's been around so long, it's really kind of sustainable practice that's less extractive than a lot of technologies. So it's kind of learning this about how something like programming, as it becomes passed down from generations and does become its own kind of heritage technology, how it can be more open to change, more open to being part of life, and more open to different people.
Hence it being, Tidal Cycles being free.
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. Yeah. And it's not, yeah, I guess free open source software is just what I've grown up with. And so it's not something I think about too often. But I think, yeah, having something that's free, both in terms of you can download it or use it for free, but also sort of open to change, that you can add to it, contribute to it, use it in some other project, use it as a kind of collective good that you can share and add to. I think that's really important.
That then leads me to my final question, which is, what is then the future of music technology?
I think for me, to find the future of music technology, you have to look at the past, really, because music is continually developing, but it also goes in cycles. I think when you see things like supply chains break down, it's clear that the current kind of trajectory of getting faster and faster hardware is continually getting more and more complex, more and more expensive, and more extractive of the environment is going to end at some point. This is something that Devine, who made Orca, is really interesting on. They are really sort of exploring the idea of technology that is designed to survive past collapse, and Orca's part of that. So making systems which can run on any hardware that's powered by any solar panel, doesn't have to be on grid. I think that's the future, really, kind of getting really at the fundamental of what music technology is, so that it's not reliant on this idea of infinite growth. But there's so, when you look at something like Carnatic music, it is so rich and so complex, and there's so much to learn. Like, for me, algorithmic music is so it hasn't been around that long, our current idea of algorithmic music. But when you look at something like Carnatic music, it's so rich in terms of how it's performed and how it's built up this kind of culture of patterns and structures that have created this really interesting creative ground to explore. There's so much to learn. So, yeah, I guess that's my answer, really, is in a way, coping with less, but using that in order to get really at the fundamentals and end up pushing it further, exploring more. That makes sense.
It does. It's a good answer. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Right. Yes, mate. Thank you, Alex. And I hope you have listened to that and thought, I really want to try tidal cycles or Strudel or like Hydra or these other things, or Orca, in fact, that we mentioned as well, or the Teletype, which is in VCV Rack, by the way. Go to strudel.cc and you will see there are help documentations. The other day, I thought I would give it a go, and literally within 3 or 4 minutes, I'd got a sound and was writing little riffs for it and playing around. And I tried .jux brackets REV, and suddenly it was all reversed in the other side in a beautiful way. And so I was getting results. It was amazing, right, in a browser. And by the way, this will also work on a phone. So you could be on your mobile phone or on an iPad and also go to strudel.cc. There is nothing to install. If you want to try tidal cycles, it is free as well. And then you have a piece of software running on your computer locally, which you may prefer or whatever. But my main takeaway here is I want you to try this. I just think it's really cool. I think it's absolutely completely and utterly in line with everything that I've been interested in with regard to modular synthesizers. And it puts that same kind of experimentation and just,
you know, what happens if I do that kind of headspace? And it just makes it so much more accessible in that sense. That is not to say that there isn't something wonderful about having a modular synthesizer and patching it. Obviously there is. But the fact of the matter is that a modular synthesizer is going to be, you know, thousands of pounds. And you are listening to this right now on a device that you will have a web browser on. So you could just go and try this and just see what happens. I love, love, love that Algo Raves are communal events. And of course, as Alex said, code should be a cultural, communal experience. That is an interesting takeaway, along with the fact that it's patterns all the way down. Alex has given me a whole load of links to share, which I've put in the descriptions of the show notes and obviously in the description on YouTube if you watch this. By the way, if you're listening to this and you couldn't see, there is a visual version of this podcast where you can see me and Alex talking and also see Alex's screen as he was coding. Very hard to see that on a audio podcast, apologies. But yeah, have a look. There may be Algo Ravens or communal coding events near you. And that could be a wonderful way of meeting more people and also, you know, meeting experienced people and seeing what they do. Or as Alex says, just book a gig. Give yourself a month or two. You know, when I say book a gig, I mean find an open mic night or something and then go and do some code. But let people see what you're doing, I suppose. It's that idea. What intrigued me about it is this fact that I could see by just looking at the code that there isn't a great deal to learn to get the basics down. It's just a case of learning a few basic commands and the structure of sentences that you place. But the actual code you write is literally like a word and a modifier. It's like one word and a modifier. Like you've worked out most likely a really high-end DAW or, you know, many aspects of the craft of music production, from sound design to mixing to mastering. I am sure that you listening to this are likely to be a person with quite a few skills in that regard. And so I reckon you can learn a few words and write them into a browser and see what happens. So, yeah. I encourage you to try Strudel, Tidal Cycles, or any of the other live coding things. Orca is a really interesting one. I have played with that myself. Don't really recommend trying to find an instructional on YouTube. It's a wonderful way to distract yourself from doing some work that you're supposed to be doing, I'm sure. So if nothing else, allow me to enable that. You know, you'll be like, oh, well, I'm allowed to bunk off work because I'm being creative. So yes, strudel.cc, and thank you, Alex. There are links in the descriptions. Now, on the subject of, you know, finding work or working efficiently, last month I mentioned at the end of the podcast to follow your passions. This whole idea of, like, you know, if you have some kind of, there's something you've been wanting to try, well, please, will you go and try it? Go and do it. And actually, interestingly, almost right after I published that, I read a book that basically is like, you're wrong. You're an idiot to say that. But it said it in an absolutely brilliant way. And I can clarify what I meant and what the book meant. And the book is by a guy called Cal Newport, who is a guy who writes a lot about work and sort of ways to work more efficiently and deeply. And his book is called So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is a Steve Martin quote, which is basically to say, if you want to become a success and be financially compensated and have a career doing something that you love, then become so good at it that people cannot ignore how great you are and basically end up throwing money at you. Now, that's the sort of weird back end version of it, but the front message of the book is the idea that the traditional advice of follow your passions, that is to say, if you love something, doing something, try and get a job doing it, that is generally bad advice, in the sense that it's unlikely that you will get a job doing something that you love unless you have kind of demonstrable powers and skills and expertise in that industry. And what I meant by follow your passions is more to say, I think you should try new things. And that's maybe why I'm bringing this up here, especially with things like live coding. It's like, well, there's no barrier. It's not going to cost you anything. It's just a bit of your time. So go to strudel.cc and just play because you might discover something that you love. That's what's so intriguing to me. But I think that idea of what the book is talking about, what it does so well is it basically offers a kind of practical approach to trying to find a fulfilling career that gives you more time. If I was to qualify my previous statement along the lines of Cal Newport's book, what I could definitely say is that, or what happened to me, was by being passionate about music technology and by learning as much as I could about it, absorbing myself in it with all of my spare time, spending all my spare money on things and learning how they work and trying everything, that gave me some expertise, which is not to say that I'm an expert on anything. You know, I am just a person who has been interested in music technology and has absorbed myself into it. And so I have absorbed a lot of knowledge and experience in many aspects, but I'm not an expert on everything. And I, you know, I just don't think anyone should really self-appoint themselves as experts. But the book is amazing from that perspective of giving you a framework to say, if I was interested in it, what is a sort of practical approach to becoming a professional that can be paid for this? When should I take the leap from my day job to do something else full time that I am perhaps more passionate about? Well, the book actually gives a kind of practical approach to doing it. And the reason it resonated with me is that it basically described what has happened to me over the last 20 years. And the fact that I am currently doing this as a job is owed to the fact that I grew expertise in my field. I became very knowledgeable about many aspects of it, and not all, but many. And that, and what I have done to put myself out there has led to things like meeting people, developing skills, talking at events, doing presentations. All of these things add up and they make you able to then sidestep into something else. But what it sort of comes down to is developing expertise and sort of being known within that. There's a whole lot more to it, but I really recommend it. It was very interesting. He's written lots of other good books. Deep Work is a great book. Digital Minimalism as well, all about the problem of smartphones, the distractiony world that we live in. There maybe is a follow-on for last month. I urge you to maybe consider looking at that book. So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport. Well, if you liked this, please consider sponsoring on Patreon. I'm serious. Patreon.com/MylarMelodies. Patreon is sort of not really growing very massively, and so I'd definitely appreciate if you've been enjoying these. Please do consider sponsoring, because it will help production of future episodes and everything else that I do. So yeah, I'll be okay for the moment. Please consider it. And I really hope you enjoyed this. I want to thank Alex for taking the time. I was able to go to his like little office in Sheffield and chat to him, and it was such a nice time. He's really lovely, and I was really stoked to talk about this, because it's just really interesting. It's like a so close a world to the world that I live in, but also so very different in many respects. Now, that's what makes it intriguing. And it's also right at my fingertips. If I wanted to do it, I just have to go to strudel.cc or use my installed copy of Tidal Cycles now. Easy. So I hope you'll try it too. Bit of homework for you. Well, that's it. We're done. Thanks, mate. Thank you for sticking around and listening. Thanks to our sponsors, Thonk and Signal Sounds. And thank you. We'll see you next time.